I think all of us, one time or another, has met someone that was the kind of person that just bubbled over with joy and happiness, and someone that just lifted up everyone that they came in contact with. I remember one such individual. It goes back a long time ago. When I was attending seminary in Chattanooga, Tennessee, there was a student on campus, and he lived on campus, and I was a married student living off campus, so never really got to know him very well, but would meet him walking down the street or in the library or here and there. He was always joyful. He seemingly knew everybody on campus and spoke to everybody and talked and laughed, and encouraged other people. If he wasn't talking to somebody, he was singing a song. I mean, out loud, singing a song, walking down the street to the top of his voice. When you meet someone like that, they just stand out. They're rare individuals. And their joy is infectious and cannot help but lift your soul. I never ever met him, saw him, or observed him when he was in any way, shape, or form in a sad state of mind. He was always joyful. That's how you know it's real, I guess. Or maybe you might think it's not real because it's so unusual. But you knew this guy just loved the Lord, and that love was within him. He was, I would say, the personification of Christian joy. And he was blind. He tapped along with a cane everywhere he went. That is the kind of joy that all of us should be able to exhibit, possess, in spite of whatever adversity that we are facing. I'm not so sure we do a really good job at that. Whether we like to admit it or not, we often buy into the world's concept of happiness. That it depends on the circumstances. Depends on whether I'm enjoying myself, whether life is pleasurable, whether I have possessions, money, or whether I'm being entertained at the moment, or fulfilled in what I want to do, and so on. And then there's that flip side, too, that we mentioned last week. Going along with that is the avoidance of all sorts of anything that can go wrong, trouble, disappointment, frustration, whatever it is. If life can go along like that, if everything can just turn out okay, then we think we would be happy. But you see, the thing about it is, life's never like that entirely. Maybe for a little stretch of time here and there. But if that is on what your happiness depends, your happiness will come crashing down to earth sometime soon. Jesus says something totally different about happiness in the Beatitudes. First 12 verses of Matthew 5. The introduction, if you will, to what is called the Sermon on the Mount. Last week we looked at the first of the two Beatitudes, verses 3 and 4. We will continue on today. We said last week that these pronouncements, such as we looked at last week, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's a pronouncement, we said. A pronouncement Jesus made of joy, of a what would be, should be, could be for us, but certainly for those that experience it, what is a joyful reality based on a person's meeting of some specific conditional requirement. Now, this is different than the world's kind. The world says, my happiness depends on what happens to me. Jesus is saying, my happiness depends on what I choose to understand and believe. Those are the conditional requirements you see here in these 12 verses. I want to add a little bit more to our definition this week. I want to make sure that we understand. The Beatitudes are about God's expectations of us. When we read this, you might miss that. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It doesn't really say do anything. It doesn't really make a specific command. But yet, inherent in that statement is the fact that God expects us to be poor in spirit if we expect to be happy. So they're about God's expectations of us. And we noted last week that being poor in spirit means to have a humble attitude. And then last week we talked about Beatitude number two, blessed are those that mourn. And we talked about how that meant, and we understood it as we looked at it, it meant to be mournful or to be grieved, if you will, over sin, to have a grieving conscience. And you can find verses throughout the New Testament, different places, that confirm that both of those things are God's expectations of us, such as James 4, where we're told specifically that we ought to mourn over sin. So the Beatitudes are about His expectations for us, but they are also indications. Not only expectations, but they are indications of our future kingdom status. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's future tense. Our present moment happiness should be controlled by or determined by our future reality. Our relationship with God and what that means and what all that will entail in the future. And so when we are able to display a spirit of humility, it is an indication that we understand what God has for us in the future, and we can be happy. You know, prideful people are never happy. You ever notice that? Because somebody's always got more than they do or can accomplish more than they can or whatever. And so they're never, ever quite happy. But a humble person can be happy based on the promises God made. So the Beatitudes are not only expectations of God in regard to us, but they are indications to us personally that we have more to look forward to than this life. But we have a status in the next life already determined by our faith in Jesus Christ. And that results in our present happiness, or should result in our present happiness. Now, if we are unable to be humble, if we're unable to maintain and obedience in that area, then we will lose a good measure of that happiness we could have. So that's all connected. We need to understand it that way. As we said last week, the word blessed is a basic Greek word for being happy, fortunate. Jesus, however, uses it in a deeper sense than was ever used in Greek literature up until his time. He uses it to refer to that very deep-seated sense of joy, a state of joy that a Christian can have based on their relationship with God and their future with God, a joy that does not depend on present circumstances. And so, again, this week I'll ask you the same question I asked you last week. Are you happy? Now, that might entail a different answer for different people at different times and then maybe even right now. But the point is, all of us should be happy right now if we know the Lord Jesus Christ, if we have been born again, and if we apply the principles we find here in the Beatitudes. Happiness does not depend on our present circumstances. And so last week we began to look at these Beatitudes and answer the question, well, on what does our happiness depend? And we noted already last week in verse 3 that it depends on having an attitude of humility, being poor in spirit. We also noted last week in verse 4 that it depends on having a grieving conscience when it comes to sin. Not accepting sin or winking at sin or, you know, thinking that it's something insignificant. No, seeing it for what it is. We want to move on now this week into verse 5 for our third specific requirement for achieving happiness. And that is this, a compliant restraint. You say, what does that mean? Well, I'm going to explain that hopefully, but it's the phrase you find here in verse 5 that says, blessed are the meek. Now, as soon as you say that, blessed are the meek, we have 100 different concepts in our mind about what that word meek means. To some people, it means being weak, retiring, shy, backward, non-assertive. And it touches on some of that, but not all of it. Meekness is all about control, self-restraint, self-control. Maybe better put, the Spirit's control of your life. Compliant because our restraint, our ability to control ourselves should be brought into conjunction with the will of God. And God gives us the parameters of our character and our attitudes and our choices in the Word of God. There are certain things that we should do and certain things we should not do, and that's all a matter of yielding to the Spirit, exercising control over our lives. Now, the word meek that you find here in verse 5 was used to refer to the breaking of a colt or a horse from that point before when no one had ridden the animal, and if someone tried, the animal would not allow that or would try to resist that or try to throw the rider off. Coming to a point where the animal is broken to a rider. And he no longer resists the one who sits on his back and determines which way he should go and when he should go and when he should stop and how fast he should go. When a horse or any animal is broken in that fashion and comes to that point, they become compliant with the wishes of the rider. to understand then what the scripture says when it says we are to be meek, we have to understand we're like the horse who is yielded to the control of God in our case. Meekness is not in any way a reference to being cowardly or fearful. It has nothing to do with weakness at all. It's about submission. Willful submission to the control of another. Meekness is not about weakness, but it's about power under control. The horse is very powerful. The horse is more powerful than the rider in our illustration. Of course, we're not more powerful than God, but when you look at the word and the way it was used in those days, the horse has plenty of power. It's a submissive will that brings the power and the strength and the ability of that animal under the control of the rider. So when God says we need to be meek, when the scriptures indicates that, it means that we need to be submissive to the will of God, our master. A meek person puts away all harsh, competitive, defensive, and self-absorbed behavior. Puts away all harsh, competitive, defensive, and self-absorbed behavior that might benefit him or her in favor of following the will of God, which will definitely be of great benefit. Now, please understand. To be meek does not mean that we never speak up. Being meek means being under control. Being meek means doing things in the right way. It doesn't mean never defending yourself, never being assertive, or never confronting someone. That's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about how you do those things. And in some cases, maybe the choice not to do them at all, if that's God's leading. In other cases, he may lead you to be verbal with your feelings, but to be controlled. Meekness is about being under control. Meekness is about being unselfish, self-sacrificing, and submissive in behavior. You know, there's two types of employees. Let me tell you which two types there are. There's employee number one who goes to work, and the only thing that he's really concerned about is being seen, being recognized, being rewarded, or benefiting some way in someone else's opinion. Achieving some level of recognition that brings him benefit or brings him success or puts more money in his pocket or gets him a raise or whatever it is. And then there is employee number two. You have to look hard for this guy. This type of employee do all they can do to be seen, but not for their own benefit. They do all they can do to achieve something good, but not for their own benefit. They may well be recognized and rewarded, but everything they do for the good of the employer. and the success of the company. That's the kind of employee you want to have. And when an employee realizes that that really is the pathway to their own benefit, although many do not, when they realize that, then they become a good employee. It's a matter of disposition. It's a matter of choice. It's a matter of their will. It's a matter of whether or not they willfully, joyfully, effectively submit their will to the will of the boss, the company, the corporation, whatever. I'm going to ask you a question. Which of those two employees should a Christian be like? Well, that's a pretty easy answer, isn't it? Pretty easy answer. And there's lots of scripture that back that up. Jesus came riding into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, how? Lowly. Riding on a colt. The word lowly, in Matthew 21:5, same Greek word translated meek right here. He was the king. He was offering himself as the king, but what he was doing, he did in a meek and lowly way. Not in a demanding, forceful sort of way. Because that was the will of the Father at that juncture. Now, when he comes back, next time he won't come that way. But that too will be within the control of the will of God, obviously. When Jesus was accused of blasphemy and all the rest by the Jews, when they illegally tried him on the night before his crucifixion, he never spoke a word in his own self-defense. Now, he could have, and it wouldn't have been sinful, except that it wasn't the will of the Father for him to defend himself. He was very, very meek. We are told in Galatians 5:23 that we need to be yielded to the Spirit, and the fruit of the Spirit should characterize our life. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering. Then there's this word you come to at the beginning of verse 23, Galatians 5:23, translated gentleness. It's the same Greek word found right here in Matthew 5:5. Meekness is something God expects us to have. I've known believers over the years. We're very meek individuals. I've seen Christians who come along and envision a project or a ministry of some sort, and they work hard, and they see it come to reality, and then somewhere along the line, someone else gets excited about that ministry, and they get involved in it, and they're a more forceful personality, and they kind of give it an extra little bit of energy, and ultimately, everybody gives that second person all the credit for what happened. And the person who is responsible for it all, who is meek, just steps back and quietly rejoices the Lord's work is being done, regardless of who's credited with it. That's meekness. Now, the meek shall inherit the earth, according to what it says here. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. He doesn't say they will inherit part of the earth. It says they will inherit the earth. Over in the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 7, it says those who overcome, that is the believers, shall inherit all things. When I was a youngster growing up in rural West Virginia, most everybody's farms and woodlands were open for anybody to go hiking, exploring, or hunting, or fishing, or ponds. It was just the way things were in those days, except for just a few places. And Dad would always say, "Now don't go there. That farm is posted." Oh, that was the bane of a young man. No. Because that's where all the game was at, for sure. I mean, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. I mean, the fish in that pond over there, man, if you could just get in that pond to fish. Let me tell you something. In the millennial kingdom, there won't be any no trespassing signs. It'll belong to you and me, all of it. When you realize a little bit about what we have waiting, that will bring joy into your heart. A submissive attitude of meekness. You know, you want to determine whether you're really meek, just check your home life. Fellas, how do you react when you just get home from work and you get supper over and you just get ready to do something, some project you had in mind, you just get started on, or something's important that you're involved in, and you just no more than get started, and your wife says, "Honey, would you do such and such?" We've all been there, right? Or maybe it's one of your children will say, "Daddy, could you come and do this? Or you could come outside and throw the ball with me," or whatever. That'll determine right there how meek you are, how you react to that. Whether you're willing to submit your will to the good of someone else. Now, I know some of you are thinking, "Pastor, you lost it. Doesn't the Bible say, wives, submit to your own husbands? Shouldn't it be the wives who are submitting to us? Isn't that what it says in Ephesians 5:22? Wives, submit to your own husbands." Well, wait a minute, though. Back up to verse 21. What does verse 21 say in Ephesians 5? Submitting to one another in the fear of God. There is a sense and an aspect at which we as husbands, though we are the head of the home, submit ourselves to our wives or our children for their good. That's a submission, a meekness, if you will, that is directed toward the benefit of another person. Wives, submission to their husband, that's about submission to authority, but verse 21 is about submission for ministry. And that's meekness. And then number four, this is only number two for today, but number four, if you count last week's two requirements, righteous ambition. Compliant restraint brings us joyful lives. Righteous ambition does the same. Again, now in the book of Matthew, chapter 5, at verse 6. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." Righteousness is as much a necessity of the spiritual life as water and food is a necessity or are necessities for the physical life. Without righteousness, we'd have no standing before God. But those who place their faith in Jesus Christ are declared righteous, justified. Positionally, we have righteousness, but we still have a battle to fight in this lifetime because of our sinful nature. And there are times in life, just like when last week we talked about mourning over sin, there are times in life when we do not make the right choices, when we make sinful choices and we do wrong things, and we realize that and we have to confess that and we face that battle, we face that conflict day in and day out, but at the same time we have a hunger and a thirst for being able to overcome those temptations and those weaknesses. We should. I still remember many, many years ago, my freshman year in high school, I went out for the football team, and we started practicing the 1st of August, and it was about 90 degrees in the shade that year, and they'd send you out there for about 2 or 3 hours practice, a couple hours in the morning, then you go back for a couple hours or maybe more in the afternoon in the real hot heat of the day with all that football equipment on. And they gave us exactly zero water to drink. I mean, in those days, you'd probably get put in jail for doing that today if you were a coach. I don't know. But in those days, they never gave athletes any water. They thought, well, out there in that hot sun, you give them a bunch of water, it'll make you sick, and blah, 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 blah. I remember coming home from those practices and just taking, sometimes we'd have I don't know what you call it, one of those jugs with a little spout on it, you know, just full of water, about 2 gallons of water. I remember just taking unscrewing the lid on the top and just drinking it for about 30, 40 minutes, just sit there drinking that ice water. That's the best water I ever had in my life. I can still taste it. We need to have a thirst for righteousness that equals that. A hunger and a thirst for what's right. Now, we won't see that come to fruition until Jesus comes back and we're changed, but that desire should already be there. At the same time, we are tormented and vexed to live in such an unrighteous environment, just like Lot was. We're told that in 2 Peter 2, 7 and 8. King James translation says Lot was vexed. The New King James says he was tormented by the evil and the sin of his environment, his culture. So when we are revulsed by what we see in our culture and what we read about and what we observe in the media and what we're told about, that's a good sign. We ought to be. And without that, we won't have any true joy. But we've got to connect the dots. We can't dwell on that reality of where we live today. But understand, that'll all be rectified. And we will, one day, be in a different place. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 11, he ought to pursue righteousness. That should be a reality in our life. Now, Friday night, the storm came through. And the governor got on TV and warned everybody, and everybody was, you know, wondering how much water we were going to get and so forth. And I knew it was going to be a battle because we got this new pup at home and she'd never been out when it was raining. And I knew from experience with the former little pup of the same breed, it was going to be a battle. And she's so young, you have to take her out of bed every 2 hours. And so I stood in the backyard 2 or 3 times saying really brilliant things like, "Hurry up or we'll both be drowned in a minute." Didn't do any good. You take her out, she'd make a line back for the house. I put her on a leash, she'd run under my feet, whine. Just didn't work. My last attempt was at 12 o'clock midnight. I just gave up and just took her out in the garage. I got to get some sleep. I take her back in the house. I woke up again at 3:30. Well, it's time to take the dog back out again. So I grabbed the dog. I didn't even bother this time. I just went straight to the garage. Dog's ready to go back in. The door's locked behind me. No problem, I thought. I got to keep a key hanging by the door. I went and got that keychain. The key to the house is gone. Now, what in the world's going on? Oh, well, I hate to wake Diane up, but I'll just call her. Wait a minute. My phone is laying by the bed. Well, I'll knock on the door. So I knocked on the door. I didn't pound on it, but I knocked fairly vigorously. She's sleeping in the other end of the house, door shut, and no response. Well, there's a key hidden. No, wait a minute. We just got rid of the swing that we had the key hidden on. So that key's not there. I have no idea where the hidden key is. I could ring doorbells. I could pound on windows and all that, I think, but it's going to scare her to death. I mean, if she hears a sound in the middle of the night, you know, she wakes me up to go investigate. If she hears some banging, she's going to be scared to death. I'm not going to be there to do anything about it. What am I going to do? Well, I took the little dog and I opened the car door and I sat down and I said, well, it can only be another 3 or 4 hours before she wakes up. So I slept in the car. I didn't see anything that funny about it. At least not at the time. And I put the little mutt on my lap, and I'm sitting in the car leaning back. All that dog does is whine. I can't sleep for the dog whine. Finally, I just had to put him out. Anyway, I did sleep in the car. And when I woke up, it was like dark. I had no idea what time it was. She had already been up looking for me and was about ready to call in a missing person report. All things happen for a reason, right? I didn't realize it, but it's just what I'm talking about today. You see, my wife and I own that house. Well, that's in the bank. You know how it is. I mean, you know. It's our house. I'm going to sleep in my bed. Unless I do something dumb like this again. I mean, I'm going to sleep in my bed every night, right? And it's shielded from the weather, and it's warm in the wintertime, and it's cool in the summertime, and, I'm blessed. I just couldn't get in the door that night, that's all. Now, that's exactly the situation you and I are in spiritually. We've got a residence prepared for us. I go and prepare a place for you, Jesus said. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. We just can't get in the door yet. But it's ours. Shouldn't that bring us joy? Shouldn't that make us willing to sleep in the car for 2 or 3 hours? Shouldn't it put a smile on our face?